Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER here in Sydney, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program today...
For this to work, people have to trust the government, and they have to trust its motives, and they have to trust the implementers, and they have to trust the operator.
In China, facial recognition software is matching people's faces as they cross the street. We have a look at what our own government is doing to cross-reference our digital identities, perhaps at the cost of our privacy. Also coming up on the program...
A good understanding of what impacts are of a business, not only on consumers, but on broader stakeholders, including the community, is really an important driver for responsible business practices.
Yeah, it seems that culture is a bit of a problem with our banks following the Hayne Royal Commission, and we dig deep to find out what should be happening in the largest sector of our economy. All this and more coming up on The Money. Yes, the final report released by the Hayne Royal Commission into misconduct to the banking, superannuation and financial services industry has been released, and it's setting off reactions right across Australia, all throughout Australia's financial industries. The report listed 76 recommendations and include 24 referrals for criminal or civil action to be taken by regulators. Kevin Suarez has more.
Earlier this month, the Hayne Royal Commission passed down 76 recommendations on the misconduct of the banking, superannuation and financial services industries. The final report recommended several changes on how mortgage brokers operate, such as the removal of trailing commissions, with Commissioner Kenneth Hayne questioning why brokers should be benefiting from a loan when the work had already been arranged and completed. It also made recommendations on making mortgage brokers act in the best interests of their borrowers instead of the banks, giving regulators more powers, and to stop the excessive selling methods for superannuation and insurance products. Former ANZ economist Professor Warren Hogan of the UTS Business School says regulators APRA and ASIC could have more power under the recommendations.
The main thrust of what the commissioner is trying to do with the regulators is to change their approach to how they enforce the law and breaches of the law within the financial services sector. And there's a very strong theme that comes from the final report that there has not been enough emphasis placed on the prosecution of what the commissioner calls wrongdoing. So really, I think these regulatory agencies were already well aware of their need to become more aggressive in their pursuit of wrongdoing within the financial system, and that has been emphasised in this final report.
24 cases of misconduct listed in the report have been referred to regulators for criminal or civil action to be taken against them. While organisations were targeted, some individuals were also criticised by the commission. Professor Hogan explains how the way regulators operate could change if the recommendations are taken up.
Clearly, there is a number of instances that have come out of the proceedings of the Royal Commission. In fact, the final report includes, I think it is 24 referrals to the regulators around specific instances of what may end up being breaches of the law, whether it be criminal or civil. So I think this is a significant shift in the way our regulators go about their business, and most importantly that they are going to seek action in the courts and look for convictions on a much more regular basis than they have in the past. So the biggest impact of this shift is going to be on people within the financial services industry who are not doing the right thing.
Dr. John Hewson of ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy feels the government isn't clear on how they will handle the recommendations and how they will pass them through to Parliament.
Well, look, it's a few months before an election. Both sides of politics are going to say they're going to implement it fully. As always happens in these things, it depends exactly how it's all interpreted over time. how it's translated into regulation and new legislation, whether that gets through the parliament. So they're both saying that they'll do that. We just have to wait to see how that ends up. But quite often in the past, these things get watered down, reinterpreted, redefined. You know, there's still a way to go before people would feel that they've achieved some sort of significant result from this Royal Commission.
Mortgage brokers have responded to the final report, warning against a crackdown on the industry. Professor Hogan has more.
In certain parts of the financial system, there appears to already be quite a significant response to the report, not so much in the banks, but in the mortgage broking community. Certainly, if you look at the values of listed companies, the initial response from the market has been to mark down mortgage brokers that are listed quite heavily. Banks have actually rallied, their value's gone up, and that represents some relief that there is no fundamental structural shift around the banks that will cause their profitability to decline.
Meanwhile, Dr. Hewson says the banking industry hasn't fully acknowledged the recommendations made in the final report.
They have not really acknowledged the full extent of the board's role and responsibility in this. The board's fish rots from the head. These cultures are set at board level, and the delivery of them is accounted for at board level. You know, so the boards can't wash their hands of it and walk away.
He believes the changes recommended to be made to the mortgage broker industry will be positive for those seeking their services.
Well, I think it'll change the nature of mortgage brokering. You know, the old idea of writing a mortgage and getting a fee that trails over a period of years, or the life of the loan, I mean, those days are gone. They're going to get rid of trailing fees, which is a good thing. And secondly, it's a good thing that there is going to be more transparency and accountability in terms of fees. And thirdly, of course, to change the nature. They've suggested that there be a change in the nature of fees, but, you know, and who pays them. And these are significant steps in the right direction, I think. It's just how in the end they manifest themselves in legislation or regulation.
Dr. Hewson explains how the Commission took an interest in the mortgage broker industry.
We have had a funny system, and they've pointed to the fact that the mortgage brokers are paid by the banks, and in fact in many cases the mortgage brokers are owned by the banks to give them a flow of mortgages. I think one of the key recommendations is to have the fee for a mortgage broker paid by the customer, but it's not clear how that fee would get set and administered. The mortgage market has overheated for a lot of reasons, not just because the banks lent money to people who couldn't afford it, so they have a very significant percentage of what we might call subprime. They're not technically subprime, but they are subprime loans. They've lent people more money than they knew they could afford. But there's also been, there's the run of foreign investment, tax incentives, and so on, all of which have underwritten a fairly strong demand for housing over a fairly extended period of time.
Dr. Hewson outlines ways the banking industry could prevent drifting back into their bad habits.
Well, I think the boards have to recognise the role that they've played in setting this culture up and undo some of the elements that I've just mentioned in terms of strategy, in terms of give more weight to interests of customers, employees, suppliers, the broader community, for example, not just profit. Give, you know, change the remuneration structures. They've been paid some very large amounts at senior management level. I think the Rev got about $43 million for his time at the Commonwealth Bank. You'd say that's hard to match with the performance of the bank during that period. You know, so the bank can change that. I think in regulatory terms they can be more closely monitored, but maybe we have to have public interest directors appointed to boards and things like that. I don't know. I haven't got a specific proposal, but there are plenty of ways in which you could address the issue.
Dr. John Hewson of ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. In 2018, Peter Dutton introduced draft legislation that would allow agencies such as ASIO and the Federal Police to access encrypted data for individuals and businesses. Michael Lester from Radio Northern Beaches asked Paul Shetler from Accelerate HQ and previous CEO and head of the federal government's Digital Transformation Agency under Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull just what the concept of digital identity was and why the government was putting so much money into this.
If you look at it from the standpoint of a user, you know, anybody who uses government services, every time you log in, every time you want to access a government service, it asks you to identify yourself. Again, it tends to have no idea who you are. You've got to enter the same details each and every time that you access a different service. And sometimes you wonder, you know, why do you have to do this all the time? Why are you constantly entering? Why are you constantly having to identify yourself in different ways to different government services, states, cities, federal, or different federal agencies to get anything done? It's incredibly frustrating for users, and it's very expensive. It's just very wasteful for government as well. So it's been a longstanding complaint that, you know, identifying yourself to government is very difficult when you need to get government services. So we wanted to do something to make it easier for people to do that.
Right. So the core concept, as far as the government's concerned, you're saying is that it's about streamlining user access to a whole range of government services. I believe already that we have in place a digital ID type system with Australia Post, and I think the trial they're launching is with the Australian Tax Office. And of course, facial recognition of individuals and whatever we're familiar with in the automated gates for passport control when you arrive in Australia. So there seem to be some elements of this around already. But what is the technology at the heart of this concept?
There are elements around it already, but the fact is that typically they're not used in any kind of way that makes it easy to use the government services. I think one of the problems we have right now is that for all those good intentions, it's being delivered by agencies that don't have a terribly good track record when it comes to dealing with users or public trust.
Yeah, well, as you say, public trust is at the heart of this concept, I guess, and
it's the core of it, right? For this to work, people have to trust the government,
yes,
and they have to trust its motives, and they have to trust the implementers. And they have to trust the operators.
That's a hell of a lot of trust, not least against the background of history. We could go back, couldn't we, in Australia anyway, to 1986, when the government proposed there should be a national identification card, a unique identifying card for every Australian, never made it past the public. The government could never implement it.
Was that the Australia card?
That was the Australia card, a national identity
card. It was an access card too, I believe, right?
I think so, but this was well before the days of internet and sophisticated digital technology in 1986. But even then, they could not muster enough trust on behalf of the public.
But the larger question that you're bringing up is correct, right? If you've got these agencies involved in digital transformation of government, the DHA is involved in digital transformation of government as DTA is, and if their own privacy people are saying, wait a second, this isn't being taken seriously, then we do have a problem, right? And we have the problem also against the backdrop of operational failures. And we can call them operational failures, or we can call them something else if we want. At DHS, you know, with the problems with RoboNet, you know, the problems with the tax office, the problems with the census, the problems at, you know, ABS, and so on and so forth. It's one thing after another. There's a general issue with both the seriousness of government, and then that sometimes leads people to wonder about the intent in government.
I must admit, I'm not exactly clear. On the one hand, we talk about a digital identity and what have you, whatever that may be. But on the other, it seems to be very closely linked to the idea of facial recognition software. The government is apparently creating a database which, by matching faces, which they have in things like licenses and passports and whatever else, yes, against faces, then apparently they've developed technology to have a database that does this matching and carry the data, which apparently has two components, a face verification service and a face identification service. What exactly is going on here, and what is the role of this face recognition software as part of a national digital identity?
I think the reason behind that was it was viewed as everybody in Australia, or most people in Australia, you know, they have driver's licenses, or they have some kind of an ID card that the government has issued them that has their photo on it. It has their face photo on it. And the idea was, the design, that if we could make it so that people could just simply take a selfie on their phone and then compare that with the image that we have on record for them and say, oh yeah, this is the same person, or no, this is not the same person. But that would be a lot, you know, that would be a fairly simple way of doing things. Now, I don't know these other, you know, video tracking or anything like that. You know, I've heard some rumors about this in the last week or so, but I don't know anything about it, any details about it. Needless to say, that is alarming. It's true, but I don't know how real that is.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been reading reports, particularly that come and tell us about China, where apparently they're into this in a big way, at least according to what I read. The commercial side is interesting because it's clearly a huge and growing market, and it's clear from what I see that the Chinese are really piling huge monies backed by government into facial recognition startups and all the associated AI and matching algorithms. Meanwhile, the companies in America are running into all sorts of problems and needing to call for government regulation. The money's pouring into startups and in China in all this, but it's not really happening. Apparently, in the past week or so, facial recognition startups in China raised $1.6 billion on top of billions already.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're doing incredibly well, and they're going to be selling their software to Western countries.
Of course they are. Well, that's if they're allowed to, presumably, because Huawei hasn't been allowed to operate here, has it?
Yes, there is that. But well, in general, I mean, that's why they're developing. I mean, you know, they've got great, from a standpoint of just pure technology, they have great technology. And so the question is going to be, you know, they're clearly going to be looking to market it to other countries. And it may not be marketing it to Australia. It may not be marketing it to the United States. But it will be marketing it through Africa. It will be marketing it through India. It will be marketing it through Southeast Asia. Sure, of course it will be. And they'll do very well there.
Dr. Paul Shetler from Accelerate HQ, and also the former CEO of the Federal Government's Digital Transformation Agency, speaking there with Michael Lester from Radio Northern Beaches.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcast live on the Community Radio Network. As the Hayne Royal Commission has uncovered, there are many problems in the culture of many Australian financial institutions, with many focusing on short-term profits over long-term sustainability. Culture refers to how organisations work and the way they do business. Good organisation cultures serve businesses well and allow them to thrive, but sometimes they go wrong, and the established ways of doing business can go very wrong, as in the case of our banks, which can also lead to criminal activity. Vincent Sue spoke with Kylie Porter, Executive Director of the United Nations Global Compact Network Australia, to find out just how much culture drives behaviour in Australia's financial institutions.
So I think it does have something to do with corporate culture, and not necessarily corporate culture directly driven from the sort of CEO and exco level, but also culture driven from the bottom up, and perhaps, you know, looking back at some of the hearings throughout the Royal Commission, some of the alleged criminal behaviour and some of the misconduct was actually perpetrated by individuals. And I think it would be unreasonable and probably unfair of me to assume that in all of those cases it was a direct correlation of the overall corporate culture of the financial services entity, be it whether it was the banks or the insurers. It definitely highlights the need for there to be a more ingrained ethical and trust-based culture within the financial services sector.
Do you think performance-based pay has inadvertently led to this culture, or is there something more to it, or are just humans being humans?
There is an argument that incentive-based pay has had an influence on it, whether it's, you know, and it's that inadvertent influence. I think in some cases it's probably also had a direct influence in the behaviour, particularly of individuals. I mean, when you've got a situation where the remuneration is based around a specific sales target, naturally for any human being it would drive the behaviour of trying to achieve that target, and perhaps achieve that target without due consideration for the impact on the consumer or the impact on the business.
Aside from preventing what has been uncovered, just broadly speaking, why is a good organisational culture good for banking?
I think a good organisational culture is good for any organisation, regardless of whether we're talking about the financial services sector, the resources sector, the property sector. It goes across the board. Good culture, good corporate governance, a good understanding of what the potential impacts are of a business, not only on consumers, but on broader stakeholders, including the community, is really an important driver for responsible business practices. And I think if you have a good corporate culture that is cemented around responsible business practices, and you know, if I'm looking at that from the lens of the UN Global Compact, it encourages companies to act responsibly from the offset, and act responsibly around principles of human rights and labour rights, environment and anti-corruption. And instilling a culture that's founded on those principles will actually help build trust, not only within their customer base, but across the board with all of their stakeholder groups. And it helps to inform those conversations with investors as well. So I think, you know, when the financial services sector is starting to look at how they're going to rebuild that culture across their industry, they really need to think about the ethical and trust lens behind that, and what's it going to take to regain and rebuild that trust within corporate Australia.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the Global Compact Network as well. So what sort of changes do you think needs to happen in Australian banks?
There's a lot of opportunities for Australian banks, and you know, the recommendations, you know, I haven't read the entire document yet, but the recommendations from the Commissioner really do highlight some integral and crucial things that the banking sector could consider to really lift their game. And I think there's going to be a lot of considerations around things like the role of vertical integration. So, for example, the banks that are still holding on to their superannuation arms or insurance arms, there'll be considerations around, you know, what are appropriate incentive structures for staff. And also, you know, what costs, for example, can ethically and legitimately be passed on to consumers when they're applying to a bank for credit. And that might be credit from a mortgage sense, but it might be all the way through to business lending as well. There's great space for banks to think about things from that broader ethical lens around sound institutions and what does good governance look like, and not just good governance from the sense of anti-corruption and anti-bribery and abiding by the rules of ASIC and APRA, etc., but what does good governance look like to ensure that you are that responsible business and you are an ethical business.
Going back to the first part of your answer there, do you think that the recommendations in the report went far enough?
Ultimately, we're a society that is based on capitalism, and we're a society that has supported market mechanisms for a really long time. And, you know, my view is that banks are a fundamental part of society. We rely on banks every single day, regardless of whether we're conscious of that reliance or not, anywhere from tapping your card when you're going to buy, you know, a couple of litres of milk, all the way through to being able to afford a home or purchase a car, or if you're a business, being able to fund that business. And so I think it's, in some respects, a bit naive of Australians to assume that the banking sector doesn't play a fundamental role in society, and that the banking sector doesn't consider their role in the community. And in that respect, I actually think Commissioner Hayne did a brilliant job with his recommendations. I think it gave a lot of scope for the regulatory bodies, for the government, and also for those financial services sector players to really think about what their role is in those recommendations, but it also gave the scope to think about what they could do in the future. For the time being, they are strong enough to make those fundamental shifts that need to happen in the industry.
How do you plan on working with banks to bring about these important changes, especially considering that banks have been commissioning consultants and spent millions trying to achieve this in the past?
We're in a unique position in that the four major banks are members of the UN Global Compact. We've also got quite a few of those professional services firms that you just mentioned as members as well. And one of the really big powers and positive elements of the Global Compact Network is that we are able to convene groups. So I've obviously given my banking colleagues some time to digest and think about the recommendations in the report, and then we're hoping to engage with them more actively to see if we can organise roundtable discussions and forums that will help unpack some of those recommendations and allow us the opportunity to talk about how those 10 principles, the UN Global Compact's 10 principles, could actually help shape a lot of their strategic direction going forward.
Kylie Porter, Executive Director of the United Nations Global Compact Network Australia, ending that report by Vincent Tsu. Yes, that's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Hello, if you're listening to Two Wet Tank FM in Kempsey or Alpine Radio 96.5 in the Victorian Alps or 8CCC in Alice Springs. Thanks to our producers Kevin Suarez and Vincent Tsu. On the Money is produced the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all their shows and stories at 2SER on the Money. You can also have a listen to our new podcast on iTunes or listen on Instagram. Look at us on Instagram. To follow us on Twitter, look at On the Money 2SER and find us on Facebook too. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Bluesfest Touring presents Ray LaMontagne at the State Theatre on Wednesday the 24th of April. She won't let me go. Ray LaMontagne, accompanied by Wilco's John Stirrett on bass, will highlight songs from all of Ray's 7 studio albums. It's a magical, intimate, acoustic evening at the State Theatre, Wednesday the 24th of April. Tickets through Ticketmaster, also appearing at Bluesfest, 2SER sponsor.
Ready to party? Mardi Gras Film Festival is back with another massive lineup of features, docos, shorts and special events. With 5 world premieres and over 70 Australian premieres, see the best of LGBTIQ+ films from around the globe and embrace your story. You can catch the festival in Sydney from February 13 to 28, in Parramatta in March, or the Mountains in April. Tickets on sale now at queerscreen.org.au. 2SER is a media partner of Mardi Gras Film Festival.
Last night I woke with a star, sat up in bed, had something cold and unknown in my head. All at once it occurred to me that I needed the world to see, that I want to save the world, but first I need you to save me. Well, it ain't no save.